From KCUR News, this is Casey Kearns, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, hear how Kansas Cityans weathered the snow.
I could look out across the street and see their warm, glowing lights, so I was kind of sad and lonely.
Learn about a new resource for employers who are looking to hire bilingual workers.
Our parents haven't typically worked in what some folks may consider white-collar or office-type work, and so we're not sure about which companies have opportunities out there.
And a local band rocks out in Espanol with the help of a member of Los Lobos.
Everything we went for, like, we went fully for it. Like, if we're trying to make a vocal harmony sound reminiscent of this genre of Latin singing, well, he would make sure we went all the way there.
Listen up for Casey Kearns just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Kearns is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
And this was the sound of Kansas City this week, digging out after two snowstorms dumped almost 2 feet of snow in much of the area. Even the bravest of winter weather enthusiasts found their schedules disrupted. Like Dale Miller, he had the day off of work on the Tuesday after the most recent storm. That would have meant a day of lost wages. But he and his two cousins found a way to take advantage of the snowy day.
Myself, I said, well, I can't make it to work. I can make a little money. Well, I'd help somebody out, they might need to be dug out.
Whether digging out or making a snowman or just reading a good book, many of us found ourselves doing something unexpected last week. KCUR intern Monica Sandretsky gathered some snow day stories from around the metro area.
I'm Nancy Nicolay, and I'm a school nurse, so I love snow days. I got my snow days nailed. They all pretty much look the same. Fire and food and movies. I was so excited I couldn't sleep. And I was up just watching out the window, and then as soon as I heard that it was happening, then I started building the fire, so I would have a big roaring fire, and going outside watching it happen, and immediately started cooking, and we had a jigsaw puzzle going, and we had Bailey's in our coffee, and we had movies, lots and lots of movies. And I played in the snow. I pushed my dogs around in the snow. I made goat stew, chili, meatloaf, all kinds of comfort foods.
My name is John Christmas, and I put a lot of layers on. Like, I have 2 pairs of sweatpants, 2 jackets. I was with my wife, and then we was with a couple friends. We had a snowball fight outside. We made snow angels, tried to make a snowman, but it didn't work out too good. The snow was too soft, so we really didn't know what to do. So we just went out back and had another snowball fight.
My name is Diamond Wright. I like to stay warm. I don't like the cold, but people in our dorm had planned at 3 o'clock we would have a snowball fight. So I went out there with a bunch of layers on and had a blast, actually. It was my first snowball fight, and I swear, by the time I went in, I had snow underneath my sweatpants, my gloves were soaking, my hat had snow on it, scarf had snow on it, it was just snow everywhere.
Hanan Bosheri, I'm from Kuwait. I'm not used familiar with the snow, because in my country there it doesn't snow. It's the first time that I actually get to play with it.
My name is Anthony Rashid. I have a couple of friends that we just all get together and just play the game all day. So that's about it. Playing Call of Duty all day.
I'm Laura Taylor. I was home alone. And unfortunately, fortunately for the people across the street, they had power. But unfortunately for me, I could look out across the street and see their warm glowing lights. So I was kind of sad and lonely. And I could really feel what I was missing out on. But they asked me if I needed anything. They were very kind. The neighbors next door were going to the motel, so they asked me if I wanted to come. And I thought, oh, I'll just stick it out. But it wasn't until later in the evening when it was dark and I had the flashlight that I kind of wished that I had gone. Because that was probably the loneliest part, was after the after dark set in.
My name is Shireen North. In the four houses just right around my house, all the women were out shoveling. So I think I know it was very funny. There were no men to be seen. So I don't know whether we were saving our husbands from heart attacks or we just needed to get out of the house and stop cooking and cleaning. So we were all just out together. And we had a good time. We all met kind of together in the middle of the street and we were talking. And then we'd go from one house to the other and kind of helped each other. So it was a fun coming together time for all of us.
Those snow day stories were gathered by Casey Current's intern Monica Sandretsky. The heavy snow this week caused several roof collapses around the Kansas City area, and several more buildings were evacuated for fear of a collapse, including a Macy's in Overland Park. To find out more about the Macy's situation and how to prevent roof collapses in general, KCUR's Dan Verbeck got on the phone with Overland Park Codes Administrator Tim Ryan.
What was discovered over there at the Macy's store, right? And how did they discover it?
There was some separation and some damage on some of the ceiling tiles that kind of was the catalyst for them to start looking at things. And then when they got up there, they saw some things that they weren't quite comfortable with. So then they called their engineers and they called the fire department. The fire department called us, and then we all kind of emerged out there. And we found some abnormalities in the deflection of the structure that when you get somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 or 3 inches deflection, that's beyond what the structural members should be deflecting.
If you wouldn't mind putting that in lay terms, deflection, I'm thinking of something bending inward.
Pretty much. Yeah, it's the weight. And they had some abnormalities out there, whether it was because of drifting snows or whatever. They had some areas where they had 3 to 4 foot of snow up there. And obviously we had a heavy snow, and that, because of the area of that weight, it was imposing more weight for a substantial period of time over the area of that roof area. So it was deflecting the main structural members. And you're right, it's basically bending. And at the midspans of the joists is the critical part. That's the weakest part versus the ends or towards the end. So it's when you see something deflect that much, it's cause for concern.
You probably don't see it all that often, Tim. But,
very rarely do we ever see anything like that. And when we talk about failure of steel, I think sometimes people misinterpret what that means. It doesn't necessarily break like a stick, but because of the amount of bending and deflection, typically the ends where your vertical exterior walls meet your roof area, it tends to pull apart. And that typically you'll see the collapses on the ends versus the middle of the roof or at the beam connections.
So is there a plan of action recommended or required?
Yeah. What we do, and our main concern when we get called out there, when the fire department calls us out there, our main concern is, do we have a safety issue to where the building needs to be evacuated? Now, our job was made easy on this one because the owners had already made that decision to evacuate the building, and they did. Now, based on what we saw, we would have concurred with that, and we would have also had them evacuate the building. Once the building is evacuated, then they have to get an engineer out there, and they do have an engineer that is investigating this as to, number one, what's going on? Why did it deflect as much as it did? Well, you might think, well, obviously it's the snow. It's probably true, but we want to make sure that there might not be something else there. We don't want to miss anything. So the engineer is going to evaluate that as to what is causing it, and then once they determine that, then they will also determine what the fix is. Once they determine what the fix is, then we will require them to submit that information to our office to get a permit for the repairs and any kind of construction that will need to happen. And then there will be the appropriate inspections prior to allowing that to be occupied again.
If it could happen there, I suppose it there may be a lot of other places around because everybody
possibly
got the same amount of snow.
Obviously, well, yeah. Again, what happens in a lot of these things is it really depends on the configuration of the roof, where your offsets and where the snow is going to accumulate, and things of that nature. And obviously, our biggest concern is our flat roofs. where unlike a lot of our homes in our area, quite frankly, have very steep slopes to them. You know, they usually have a 4 and 12 or steeper slope, so the snow doesn't accumulate on a sloped roof like it does on a flat roof. So the bearing and the weight is not nearly as bad as a flat roof. You know, our commercial buildings, we have a lot of flat roofs on our commercial buildings. Very few, if any, flat roofs on 1 and 2 family residential type of structures. So, you know, our residential we're not too concerned about. That doesn't necessarily mean that nothing will happen. But obviously the flat roofs are where your main concern is going to be.
Well, it's not your problem, but do you have any idea how they're going to get the snow off the roof of this current situation?
Well, obviously, I'm sure they'll hire a professional contractor that has the equipment. The thing you have to be worried about, and particularly for those single-family homeowners out there that are concerned that they want to, you know, we always recommend don't climb up on the roof yourself unless you know what you really know what you're doing. And typically what we recommend is that if you need to get the snow off the roof, if you're a residential structure, you can use even a snow shovel would help, but they do have these things called snow rakes with the telescoping handles, and you can reach out quite, and you basically would grab the snow and just pull it down off the roof and just kind of slide it down the slope of the roof. That's the best recommended practice. Now, obviously, you're on a ladder. You got to be careful. If you're really concerned about too much weight up there, obviously, we recommend you don't actually physically get up and crawl around on a roof, because then that exacerbates the problem. The other thing you got to be worried about, particularly on your single-family homes, where you've got comp roofs, you've got wood shakes, is how you scrape the snow off of there so that you don't damage the roof covering. Obviously, you want to pull the snow down in the direction that the roof is sloped. You don't want to try to push it up the roof or go across the wood shingles or the shakes or the asphalt shingles, because then you could grab them and tear them up, and now you've got a leaking problem on your roof. So on a commercial building where you get like what we're doing with Metcalf South, they're going to hire a professional contractor that maybe has a loader that can reach up there or something that they can get that snow down off of there without a lot of people walking around up on that roof.
Overland Park Codes Administrator Tim Ryan spoke with KCUR's Dan Verbeck.
Coming up, the story behind the murders. That's murders of crows that you will find hanging out around the metro. You're listening to KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. The American crow is a smart and wary social bird with all black feathers, black talons, and a black beak. Every once in a while during the winter, you can see thousands of these crows gathering in certain spots around Kansas City. Over the past 50 years, crows have been congregating more and more in urban environments. And if you've been in the middle of a dive bombing murder, you know they create quite the disturbance. Our own Suzanne Hogan's Midtown neighborhood became a popular congregation site earlier this winter. That inspired her to find out more about these mysterious birds with loud habits and a dark reputation. A large congregation of crows took over my neighborhood for a couple of weeks at the end of last December and into January. At dusk, they'd fly in. Big black crow-shaped leaves blanketed the treetops.
They were all just, like, going nuts. Screaming and throwing things.
My sister Jessica, who I live with, strongly influenced by Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, was terrified.
I don't think people realize how big they are. And they're menacing, and they hang out in packs, and they make horrible sounds. And it's my home! That's what I kept thinking. It's like, I gotta come home to this.
It was a wild party in the trees over our house that we weren't invited to. They left an awful mess. We started referring to our cars as poop leopards. The front porch was caked in bird droppings.
The first time I've ever washed my car, ever, I think.
Not knowing much about crows, in our ignorance, we resorted to making fun of them. And then, one day, they left. Even though it took a month to get the poop stench out of the porch, we wondered, why did they leave? Why had a murder of crows come to our neighborhood in the first place? I wanted answers.
Crows don't like to do anything alone or quietly.
Kevin McGowan of Cornell's Lab of Ornithology has been studying crow behavior for 25 years. He's climbed 70-foot-tall trees up into crows' nests. He marks and tracks crow families. He says crows have been congregating at dusk in the winter months to prepare to roost since there have been crows. All across North America, this takes place. The congregations include local crows who live here year-round and groups of crows from other areas who are in town for the winter and want to hang out. The places they choose change every couple days or so.
There are no leaders in this, and it does seem to be sort of a group consensus.
It's like they all have a sort of vague notion of what they want to accomplish, to pick a good spot where they all feel comfortable.
There's a tipping point that if you get enough birds to go, everybody thinks it's a good idea, and then everybody will go that way.
McGowan says that even though crows are an extremely common bird, there's a lot that is unknown about them. But he has discovered a lot of surprising things. They have strongly connected family structures. They stick together in their territories. They're cooperative breeders. Young crows help their parents raise the young. They can solve puzzles, recognize human faces, and cars.
They chase my car down the street. They know my car. They pick my car out of thousands of other cars because I'm the guy who tosses them peanuts.
And sure, people feed birds all the time. Birds love to be fed. But this is different. This proves something more. The crows know him.
The fact that a bird is looking at people and thinking about the different individuals. Do you do that with birds in your backyard? Do you think about individuals? You know, usually we don't. It's like, oh, well, there's a crow. Well, it's not just any old crow. That's a specific crow. And that specific crow could know you as a specific individual person and react in an appropriate way, depending on who you were to it.
The thought of a murder of face-recognizing crows was creating dark poetic thoughts in my mind about what the natural world is trying to tell me. But it also sparked thoughts about animal congregation terminology, like a murder of crows, which are popular to writers and nature enthusiasts. Some of my favorites are a battery of barracudas and a lounge of lizards. But McGowan dismisses that kind of talk.
To a scientist, they're all flocks. So I say a flock of geese, not a gaggle of geese. And murder comes from the fact that crows have a dark reputation because they're scavengers in Europe. They were an indication, something that happened around death, be it a battlefield or a plague or something like that. They were there to peck the eyes out of, you know, whatever they could find. But I try to get people to not use that because that just plays into that old bad reputation kind of thing. Murder with its connotations is just playing into that old stereotype, and I'd like to stop it.
Flocks of crows can get pretty massive, thousands and thousands of birds. And anytime you see a large number of animals coming together, it's usually for two reasons: to detract predators and share information about food, which are both things that are happening when crows congregate. But there's even more to it. McGowan recalls a young bird he was radio tracking in New York. The bird was part of a congregation of 5,000.
All the birds took off and went to the south towards campus, but this kid's signal went the opposite direction, and he actually turned north and went home, and he slept on his home territory that night. So he basically went for the party but didn't do the sleepover. And what that means, you know, he was there for the social stuff. It had nothing to do with predator protection or food information. He was there for something else completely. And exactly what that is, we don't really know yet.
Crow congregations in urban areas have been increasing over the past 50 years or so. It's warmer in cities. Also, crows can't see very well in the dark, so they like big, well-lit trees that city lights provide to protect them from the great horned owl. And in 1972, the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act was extended to cover crows, which protected them from their other biggest predator, people.
Up until that point, they were not protected. And then suddenly they were protected. And they're still hunted. There are still seasons on them, but you can't just shoot one whenever you see it.
McGowan thinks this has made crows less wary of people over the years.
Crows have changed their behavior, basically because we've changed our behavior.
Crows rip open trash bags and can be a general nuisance to a city, known to take over downtown areas, hospitals, and schools. But until there's some way to figure out how to attract them to roost where people aren't, we're going to have to deal with these occasional neighbors, despite any fear or hatred. McGowan knows that crows are an unpopular bird, but encourages people to try to make a little attitude adjustment.
People just think they're evil and nasty, and they don't like them. You know, I ask people about that. Why? Well, and it always boils down to they're black and they don't have a pretty song. And they're actually, crows are actually gorgeous birds. That if you see one up close, walking in the sunshine, they're glossy and with a slight purplish iridescence to it. Their feathers are beautifully put together. They're all very neat in nice patterns, and they're a very handsome bird.
At dusk, I drive around Midtown, eyes to the sky, following the crows. Friends sent me texts. Try Warwick near the Nelson, 10th and Paseo, crows are here now. I'd scramble and try to catch them, but I kept missing them. And then finally, I found them. A group even larger than the one that had been in my neighborhood, at 22nd and Woodland, near Lincoln Prep. It felt good to see them, and I wondered if any of them maybe recognized me. With spring around the corner, the crows will start to focus their energy towards the nesting season and egg laying. The out-of-town crows will go home and do the same, and the large roosts will disband until next winter's congregation start up again, which could be in your neighborhood. Believe me, you'll know when they're there. For Casey Currents, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. Hispanics are the fastest growing minority group in the United States, and Kansas City is no exception to this trend. From 2000 to 2010, Latinos made up 80% of Kansas City, Missouri's 18,000 new residents. And as Latino buying power rises, businesses are trying to attract them as customers. And healthcare organizations need bilingual staff to serve an increasing number of Spanish-speaking patients.
But where can companies find bilingual workers? Enter Gabe Munoz and his partner, Raul Duran, who created a new business last year called Hire Bilinguals. Hire Bilinguals screens and matches bilingual employees with Midwest employers. The fledgling company has two employees, and over 300 job seekers have already signed on. Gabe Munoz stopped by the studio to tell us more. Welcome to Casey Currents.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
Did you ever expect that you'd be an entrepreneur?
It's always been one of my goals ever since I was little. Even at 9 years old, I remember, you know, me and my brothers, we'd sell candy bars for our school fundraiser, and I would organize. And 1 year, you know, we actually sold over 900 candy bars in a week and a half. And it's always just been that thrive in me. I don't know. My parents, you know, were small business owners. I grew up working in other small businesses. And so it's always been a passion of mine. My undergrad, I studied finance and entrepreneurship. So it's always something I've known I wanted to get into, as to what opportunity and what industry was always just the last question that I needed to answer.
Tell me about the inspiration behind Hire Bilingual.
Well, the inspiration really came from just seeing the increasing need through my position at the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. I've, on a regular basis, started to see more and more companies calling for individuals who have bilingual skills, specifically Spanish-speaking and English-speaking skills, just because there's huge demand for the Hispanic community to market products and services to that community. However, many of the companies do not have a way to validate whether somebody truly is bilingual, and there's no proficiency standards here in the U.S. And so we saw that there was a need for companies, and it helps them be at a competitive advantage when they have somebody who really is proficient in the language.
Did any of your own experiences as a job seeker in the labor market influence how you built the website?
It did, and it still has. You know, it's a continuous with any technology, continues to change, and we want to definitely adapt to what the job seekers are looking for as well as to what employers are looking for. From my perspective, a lot of the websites I've seen out there for job seekers have a lot of jobs that tend to be work from home and tend to be, you have to pay a fee to work. And so they seem kind of like scams. And we wanted to make sure that we screen our jobs before they're posted to the website to make sure that they truly, in fact, are career opportunities for individuals.
So one of the things you say on your site is that, you know, a lot of Latinos are underrepresented and overlooked in the private sector. Why do you think this is, and how does your website help address this?
So I believe the reason, especially our community, the Hispanic community, tends to be underrepresented, it's because, especially the bilingual community, we live in two different worlds. You know, at home, we may watch Spanish media, listen to Spanish radio. Then we go to school and we take classes in English. And so we're living in two different worlds. So it's very tough to market and to reach the bilingual community. And so a lot of companies, what we see them do sometimes is strictly translate things straight into Spanish and believe that that's going to be enough to reach the Hispanic community. And it's really much more than that. It's using various media to reach out. Mobile apps are actually one of the best ways to reach Hispanics, as well as music. And so companies aren't really utilizing that.
What other kind of barriers do you think Latinos face when they are looking for a job?
Just in my specific case, and this is similar cases from many other individuals that we've seen, is our parents haven't typically worked in what some folks may consider white collar or office type work. And so we're not sure about which companies have opportunities out there and if those companies really are open to diversity. And so finding companies that have that open culture is tough for our community to find. So typically we work where we have family and friends that work. It's always that referral network, and that's with any community really. And so because our community traditionally hasn't worked in a lot of these companies, we don't typically apply to those. So we want to create awareness for our community about the companies that are out there that really do value diversity.
So walk us through. Tell me a little bit about what your website does.
So right now, our website, you can go to it. It's hirebilinguals.com. If you're a job seeker, you can upload your resume. You can. We do have on there resume tips and interview tips for job seekers who maybe aren't familiar with some of the new behavioral type interview questions that folks have to take. For employers, you can create an account and post your job on there. There is a fee to post a job. You can also look into our resume database that we have of individuals who are from the Kansas City Metro that are bilingual. And then you can also purchase ads and use our email blast to get your job opportunities out to the community.
Now, I know in my other life, I really struggled sometimes to find bilingual staff. And so you mentioned that one of the things you do is you assess the proficiency. How do you go about doing that?
Currently, we do assess proficiency. We have a proficiency scale that we use. We've actually adopted it from Europe. So in Europe, you know, there's various, so many different languages that are spoken. And so it's something there for individuals who always claim to be bilingual. But here in the U.S., we don't have anything like that. So we test individuals in regards to their reading, writing, listening, and speaking skills. We want to create the reason we entered our business competition we just entered into is we want to get funding to create technology to test and assess individuals over the internet online. But one of the hardest thing to assess is going to be speaking a language. And that's usually where individuals, there's a lot of individuals who have gone to school, who have studied. They may be able to read and write it, but speaking is always the toughest part. And so that's what we, that's what our big point is to assess individuals' proficiency in speaking.
Now, you also talk about you have a unique approach, a grassroots approach to the community in order to find great candidates. How do you go about doing that?
It's something that's always been a passion of mine. I've been involved in the Hispanic community ever since I was in high school, getting involved in high school clubs and organizations that were primarily Hispanic focused. So, you know, me and my partner, we regularly on a regular basis, we go out and we speak at local high schools. We speak to the colleges, typically to their HALO, their Hispanic American Leadership Organization groups. We reach out to some of the traditional Latino fraternities that exist here in the Midwest that a lot of companies don't even know are out there. And so this is really good recruiting grounds. Also, we reach out to a lot of the smaller towns that have huge growing Hispanic growing numbers. You know, you have Garden City, you got Liberal, Dodge City, in Southwest Kansas that nearly 50% of their population are individuals of Hispanic descent. that are bilingual, that want to move to the big city and that want to find other opportunities that are starting to go to college. And so we're reaching out to these communities to make them aware of the opportunities that exist here in the metro.
So these are mostly local jobs. Do you have any thoughts about expanding beyond local?
Yes. So right now our goal is to, you know, make sure that everybody knows we're the source to go to for bilingual recruiting and for job posting here in Kansas City. And our goal is to evolve and expand out, you know, to Kansas, Missouri, Iowa, Nebraska, Arkansas, and Oklahoma, which are all six states that over the last 10 years have seen the Hispanic population nearly triple.
Now, you mentioned, too, that competition for bilingual workers is pretty fierce. What kinds of job categories are you seeing more and more where there's a demand for bilingual workers?
In all industries, there's actually demands. You know, the medical industry, the legal field, dentist office, you got the police stations, you have schools and education, you have call centers, retail, finance industry that are all continually stressing that they're struggling to find bilingual candidates, especially those that require a degree. Less than 13% of Hispanics obtained a bachelor's degree. So when you seek a position that requires somebody who's proficient in Spanish and also has a degree, that population is definitely way smaller and makes it so much tougher because the candidates have job opportunities and they got companies fighting for them. So it makes it definitely a lot tougher for companies to recruit.
So tell me, what's in it for job seekers? I know that you mentioned that you make sure that the jobs are bona fide jobs. But how do they benefit from this higher bilingual site?
So the way the job seeker can benefit is it's a one-stop shop for them in order to get tips, in order to find companies that value the diversity. And also with us being able to assess an individual's proficiency, this creates a standard for the job seeker. So no longer if a company pays a differential, pay for that additional bilingual skill. Now with our backing and our letting companies verify or verifying for companies that somebody really is bilingual, that helps the job seeker verify that they have that skill. Just like somebody in technology who maybe has a IT networking certificate or something, when they do reach that certificate level, then you know, typically they get a pay increase. The same as with bilingual skills. If somebody has that additional skill and it's been certified that they really do are proficient, then this adds to their skill and to their value that they bring to the company.
Now, I understand that you also, in some instances, help job seekers by advising them about their application or various positions that might be open.
Yes, we do assist individuals who may have some folks who maybe it's their first time just getting out of school. They're applying for a position and maybe they don't know what a resume is or they don't have somebody they can turn to give them feedback on their resume. Or maybe they have questions as maybe they're nervous about interviewing. We can do mock interviews for the individuals. We really want individuals to have the confidence when they go into a job interview to know that, you know, they not only are qualified, but how to express their qualifications, explain that to a recruiter.
Gabe Munoz is one of the founders of Hire Bilinguals and is also the director of sales for the Kansas City Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Hire Bilinguals is a finalist in the MillerCoors Urban Entrepreneurs Series Business Plan Competition. Munoz hopes to use prize money to expand the site's offerings to other languages and other regions.
With the growth of the local food movement and a rise in urban farming, some Kansas City diners are increasingly discriminating about what goes on their plates. But a good number of people just eat what's tasty and convenient. With the premiere of Eat This, the UMKC Theater Department is serving up a unique theatrical experience exploring the social and political debates surrounding food. KCUR's Steve Walker reports.
At a recent rehearsal of a new play by Stephanie Roberts, an assistant professor in the UMKC Theater Department, about a dozen acting students are gathered around what looks like any suburban kitchen. Befitting the show's title, Eat This, the scene blends views from both sides about industrial farming, genetically modified food, and here, organically grown produce.
Growing organic food in such limited quantities is wonderful if you have that income and that choice. It's a wealthy person's choice. But for someone who lives in a third world country, that's not a choice for them. It's not realistic. They can't grow food that way, and they can't feed a large population that way.
The show is being staged not unlike a three-dimensional documentary and came together in a style that Stephanie Roberts calls devised or ensemble-generated theater. She and the cast interviewed several people in the region connected to food and the food industry, and the show took shape from those chats and field trips.
We went to a dairy farm, we went to a cattle farm, we went to a soybean corn farm, we went to a meat locker, we went to restaurants and interviewed chefs, parents, school lunch people. We interviewed a lot of people around gluten intolerance, around hunger, some people around obesity.
She adds that among all of these visits, there was one common denominator that surprised her.
I'm not from the Midwest. I'm from the Northwest. And so I would say the majority of the people that we interviewed said, well, my family comes from a farm, or I grew up on a farm, or my dad came from a farm in Oklahoma, in Tennessee, in Iowa, and you know, so that was surprising to me.
For UMKC theater student Vincent Wagner, a trip to the Hines family farm in Higginsville, Missouri, helped him recall his own family's roots in farming, and says the visit has altered his grocery shopping.
My grandmother's family ran a dairy in Jefferson City for a while, but since I've been born, it hasn't been functioning as a dairy, and so it was my first chance really to see the care that these farmers have for their animals and the work that they are very actively doing to do their work in an environmentally friendly way and in a humane way. And now I think they sell their milk to Roberts Dairy. So now when I go to the store and I see that, I can think, oh, well, that might be one of those cows that I looked at that day.
Stephanie Roberts says she and her students were not caught off guard when they found some polarizing opinions about the state of modern agriculture.
The farmers feel like they are being misrepresented. They are people who really care about the land. They really care about their animals. They care about providing food to people, yet they feel like they are being put into a category, part of this industrial machine that's unfeeling and, right, just wants to make money. On the other side, people who are part of the organic or local food movement, they might be stereotyped as militant or hippies or not open to other people's views. The idea was to find out everybody's real story.
Roberts says that the second half of the show will be catered in a way and looks forward to the post-show discussions where the cast and the audience will literally break bread together. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
The UMKC theater production of Eat This runs through next Sunday in Studio 116 of the Olson Performing Arts Center. For more information, visit the Arts and Culture section of our website at kcur.org.
After the break, the bilingual rock band Making Movies is going international with a new album produced by the saxophonist of Los Lobos. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, the Kansas Supreme Court stayed a lower court order for more school funding. The conflict over whether North Kansas City Hospital can sell its hospital intensified. And after a mostly no-snow winter, Kansas Cityans are getting caught up in snow removal. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
The second major snowstorm in a week dumped up to another foot of snow on Kansas City.
This is a really heavy, wet snow. Real different than the storm that we had last week.
Kevin Tiemann of the Cass County Sheriff's Office. Downed power lines left 98,000 KCP&L customers without power. Roofs sagged and some collapsed. And with Tuesday primaries in Johnson and Wyandotte counties, Kansas Attorney General Chris Kobach explained,
Kansas law is very clear that we cannot change the date of an election. However, there are emergency balloting procedures that are available to us.
Early voting was extended. Polls were consolidated. Few voters showed up. Among the races, Mark Holland and Ann Murguia won the rights to face off in the general for Wyandotte County Unified Government Mayor. Governor Sam Brownback got his way. The Kansas Supreme Court late Friday ordered a stay on a lower court order that the state has to increase public school funding and ordered mediation for the funding lawsuit. The Kansas House had already endorsed more power for the governor in selecting appellate judges, and the Senate a constitutional amendment to do the same thing with state Supreme Court justices. Olathe Representative Lance Kinzer said,
"A process that ensures some measure of democratic accountability is crucial in promoting confidence in and respect for the rule of law."
Fellow Republican Stephen Becker disagreed.
"We cannot have the law change with the political wind. Instead, we need to insulate and protect the court and the judiciary from the winds of change."
The Kansas Senate endorsed probable cause drug testing for welfare and unemployment benefit recipients. Two Missouri House committees said no to expanding Medicaid, and House Republicans proposed their alternative. It would cover more lower-income adults, but fewer people overall, including, sponsor Jay Barnes said, 44,000 fewer children.
"Those children have families with incomes sufficient to afford private health insurance."
The Missouri House passed a bill narrowing the state's definition of workplace discrimination, and the Senate passed one reining in some tax credits, but House Speaker Tim Jones said he didn't care much for that.
"I don't understand the argument as to why giving someone a tax credit and lowering their tax burden is bad."
The owner of the Plaza restaurant destroyed by a gas explosion last week announced that a trust fund had been set up for injured, jobless, and traumatized staff. Meanwhile, Assistant City Manager Pat Klein said the contractor that broke the gas line didn't have a permit to dig.
Had they applied?
No, not before the accident.
Heartland Midwest said they faxed in the permit application, but the city never responded. Sentiment at a North Kansas City town hall meeting was so overwhelmingly against selling the city's hospital that State Representative Jay Swearingen commented,
"I think this is a fairly one-sided audience."
And State Senator Ryan Silvey proposed legislation to remove the hospital from city control. The same day, the council said it would appoint new hospital board members more amenable to the idea of selling. This is KCUR.
About a year and a half ago, the local band Making Movies opened for the legendary rock band Los Lobos. Making Movies had been incorporating more Latin rhythms into their Spanish and English language rock, and one Los Lobos member particularly liked what he heard. Between sets, saxophonist Steve Berlin asked Making Movies if he could produce their next recording. The Kansas City band is now releasing the result, entitled A La Deriva, this week. And with the encouragement of Berlin, they're aiming to develop an international audience.
Since Making Movies has spent a lot of time touring in recent years, local shows have become a rare treat for longtime local fans. A recent show at the Record Bar in Westport turned the normally rock-drenched club into a packed dance party. From under a mane of blonde dreadlocks, singer-songwriter and guitarist Enrique Chi guided the band through a maze of Latin rhythms and experimental rock sounds. Back in September of 2011, when Los Lobos first heard Making Movies from their dressing room, they immediately became fans. Lobos member Steve Berlin explained by phone from his home in Portland.
"About 30 seconds in, I think we're all like, wow, what record is that? Man, that's really cool. It's like, there's no record. It was Making Movies doing their first song. I'm like, holy shit, what the hell's going on here? So as a band, we were knocked out. And then, you know, I sat there for the whole show. I was riveted. And then, you know, once they were done, we just started talking. And I said, you know, if you guys ever get an inkling to make a record, you know, call me first. So sure enough, they did. And I guess not very long after that, we were in the studio here in Portland making a record."
About 6 years ago, Panamanian-born brothers Enrique and Diego Chi and drummer Brendan Colt started a band named after a favorite Dire Straits album. A few years later, the Making Movies lineup was completed with the addition of percussionist and keyboardist Juan Carlos Charon. In March of 2012, the group traveled to Steve Berlin's hometown of Portland to make their second full-length recording. Enrique Chi says their new producer didn't try to change the band. Instead, he helped them take their own ideas to the limit.
I don't know what he had in his head, but he was definitely pushing and pulling for something. And we could sense it in the studio that he would push us to try to go farther with every idea. The best way that I could describe what he did to me as an artist and to us and the arrangements is that everything we went for, like, we went fully for. Sometimes we would edit down ideas, like if we're trying to make a vocal harmony sound reminiscent of this genre of Latin singing, well, he would make sure we went all the way there. And if we're trying to make a guitar part loud and nasty, we made sure it was really loud and nasty, you know. And it would nothing, and I think those contrasts ended up creating the sound that we got for the album. Pero eres lo que quiero en este mundo, lo que me hace daño. Berlin says he only had to encourage the band to do what they normally do because Enrique and the group seem to have a consummate understanding of how to make good sounds.
I think Enrique is a master orchestrator. I've very, 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 very rarely encountered any musician who I pretty much never had to touch his amp or his guitars. Like every song, he had completely dialed in a sound that was just breathtakingly beautiful and complex and kind of perfect. I you know, it almost never happens.
Recording with the music veteran was more than a little intimidating, and the band says they found themselves overthinking and worrying about what they were playing. But Berlin told the young musicians to turn off their brains and go with their instincts.
He would, you know, you push a talk back button in the studio, so you'd hear the talk back turn on. I can hear you thinking. and that was when we have to do it again.
I find that once musicians start like questioning their process and questioning, you know, what they're doing, then I can hear them thinking. You could literally hear the gears kind of grinding a little bit, and they're worried about the next note and the next this and the next that, and they're not just playing.
And then sometimes the first take, although it might have been rough in some kind of, you know, rough around the edges or had a little bit of flubs here and there, we were more thoughtless. Usually the ones that were really good were the ones where I didn't think they were the real thing. I felt like this is a run through, and I'm going to really start going for it. And those usually came out the best because we weren't in that kind of anxious state of mind.
The result of their 11 days in Portland is entitled A La Deriva, or Adrift. The songs are influenced by everything from Radiohead and My Morning Jacket to The Beatles and Led Zeppelin, while the rhythms draw from Latin beats like cumbia, salsa, and merengue. I'll be your Jesus Christ or your ego trip if you come here. The sound of making movies may move a lot of audiences to dance, but the lyrics aren't always so upbeat. A La Deriva is a concept album telling the story of a family falling apart. Its lyrics explore an abusive relationship and how that affects multiple generations. Enrique explains one song entitled Te Estaba Buscando. Una niña crece antes de su edad. Mira cómo
sueña escapar. Niña, ten cuidado. It tells a story of a young girl that it's written from the perspective of a father, and it's telling the story of him saying, I was looking for you and I can't anymore. You know, I can't find you anymore. And, you know, kind of disconnected touch with his daughter. And it tells the story of her growing up in a, you know, not so desirable part of a town and leaving home at 14, getting pregnant, becoming a single mother, and you know, falling through the sun. Kind of a similar cycle that his family had, you know, and him feeling like unfortunately that's a cycle that doesn't seem to end. And that's the concept of the record, is that, you know, that there's these cycles that exist in our society, and I don't think that we pose an answer to the question, but it just poses the question, like, what do you do? How do you break that cycle? How do you grab a 14-year-old girl that's already gotten pregnant and has already set in those courses in her life, sometimes due to things that were out of her control when she was 2 or 3 years old, set those things in motion? What next? You know, how do you amend that? Su forma de parar la tempesta cuando la enfrentamos. Por la conciencia que ya nunca nadie da. Se olvida la responsabilidad de ser humano. Cuando dormí bajo la luna, te estaba buscando.
está buscando.
Making movies has already inspired a few spin-off projects. Juan Carlos' father, Enrique, was the drummer for The Spiders. They were a 60s, 70s garage rock band from Guadalajara, Mexico, which still has a cult following. He and the Chi brothers' father met through their sons and ended up starting their own band. That group has broken up, but both fathers are now involved with a Making Movies side project called the Making Movies Social Club. As Diego Chi explains, the social club is an expanded acoustic version of the band focusing on Latin folk music.
Yeah, the Making Movies Social Club is us taking the folkloric side of it and only doing that. So Enrique plays on this Puerto Rican cuatro. The percussion is all traditional, and then I play on an acoustic ukulele bass, and then our father sits in on nylon string guitar, and then Juan Carlos's father adds percussion too. And so it makes it a really fun time for all of us because it's kind of like a family band.
Making Movies has already developed a following in lots of Midwest cities, but lately they've been spending more and more time touring on the coasts. The band is also reaching out for audiences beyond the U.S. Making Movies has a couple of dates scheduled in Puerto Rico this spring, and they've already played in Mexico. Enrique also plans to promote the band on an upcoming trip back to Panama. He says that working outside the U.S. has opened up a new world for the band.
It's actually very exciting because the United States music scene is already really established, and there's established ways to go about things. But that also leads to people being kind of burnt out. Anybody in the music business is just so over the music business because they are getting hounded by everyone, you know, from every angle. But we're hopping on the phone and talking to little promoters in Puerto Rico, and the attitude is just different. Just like, oh, we're so excited to have you, and when would you like to perform?
Now that the new record is out, Making Movies is returning to a busy touring schedule. But after working with music veteran Steve Berlin, they're hitting the road and looking at the future with a new enthusiasm.
I've been saying for a while before I met Steve, like, it's like, for better or worse, I'm a lifer. Like, I'm just going to make music to, like, you know, pass away someday. But seeing him and seeing how much energy he still has for it, yeah, that fired me up. I'm ready to go do this for 30 years. You know, like, that's the way I felt. And that's going to stay with me, I think, for a long time.
Making Movies' new recording is called A La Deriva. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
We thank you for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived along with our past shows on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our interns are Zach Lewandowski and Monica Sandreski. Theme music is by Approach, and I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.